Greetings, fellow saints. It's always good to see you. There's a lot of people homesick that are watching today. We send our greetings to you as well. Tiffany, we appreciate you watching. The Robins from Iowa. Jill Lutz is home today. Natalie Curtis is homesick. And with Jonah, my mom, Dave Miller's mom, is watching from North Carolina. Good to see you this morning. Golden Living, you're just as much part of our family as we are. And we're all in the same family, and we appreciate having you here. I have a moving announcement. On 9:30 on February 25th, 9:30 in the morning, there is a Save the Back of Doug moving celebration that is going on, and I will have pizza delivered, so if you can come to that, I'd appreciate that, and it won't be too difficult because I have a lot of stuff boxed up already, and it'll be all ready to go, and I'll try to get as much in the garage as I can, but if you can do that, please let me know because I'm making a list now, and I also need to know how much pizza to order afterwards. And make sure that you sign up on the back sheets. It's back by, if you don't know where it is, the sheets are right next to Francis Sheets, who's back there. Sign up on one of those sheets if you have not done that thus far. There's a lot of things that need to be done. The elders would appreciate that, and it will help in the furtherance of the work here at the congregation. Also, I personally gave 4 critique sheets. You're going to have a lot of different men speaking, and one of the things you can do for them to help them become a better speaker, to encourage them, to give them constructive criticism, is to... you can hand out critique sheets. I wouldn't ask you to do it if I wasn't doing it. So pick, every time you come up to speak, pick 4 people that are not your mother. And give them, 4 people who you respect their opinion, and they're going to tell you something that might help you along the way. That they'll be brutally honest with you. Don't give it to Simon Cowell. You know, give it to a brother or sister in Christ and allow them to help you receive some feedback there. Use it as an opportunity to grow in wisdom and knowledge. And also, next week, I'm going to pick out one sermon that's my favorite. I don't know which one that is, but since it's my second to last week, I'm going to pick one of my favorite sermons out for you that I've done over the years. I don't know what it is, but it'll be one of my favorites. And then 2 weeks from today, I will do my final sermon as your pulpit minister here. It'll be my goodbye sermon to you. I don't know what's titled yet, but it'll be about you. And then today's theme is this. We've already covered a lot of things. Today's theme, both this morning and tonight, is about unity. Really try to come back this evening. Football season is officially over. Try to come back this evening. Tonight we're doing a lesson called Burying the Hatchet. And this morning we're going to do a sermon called The Beautiful Bride. See, in the first century, much of what we have in the New Testament that Jesus speaks of, he actually uses matrimonial language. And that really does change our perception in a lot of these key verses that we hold so near and dear to our heart. So what I like to do is, I like to take you back 2,000 years, and we're going to go through the matrimonial process of a man and a woman becoming one before Christ. And I want you to see the language, listen to the words that Jesus spoke, and then I want to give you the background behind them. it'll not only make you appreciate what Jesus had said, but it will also, I believe, build a spirit of unity, which must exist in every congregation of the Lord. So let's go ahead and all of you get into my magical time machine. Close your eyes, okay? And those of you who were not born with eyelids, cover your eyes. And imagine for a second stepping into a time machine. Okay, it's a very efficient one. You could open your eyes. The whole building's been transported back 2,000 years ago to when Jesus walked the earth. The first step you had in the marital process had to do with the planning. And in the planning is what we call the betrothal process. In Matthew 1, verse 18, it says this. Now the birth of Jesus Christ was as follows. When his mother, Mary, had been betrothed to Joseph, they came together, she was found to be with child by the Holy Spirit. In the betrothal or the engagement process, the woman was considered legally bound to her husband, her future husband, and ending the agreement could only be done through divorce. So it wasn't like today where somebody says, will you marry me? And then there's an argument when they break up and who gets the ring and they call Dr. Laura or something. It isn't like that. You were considered legally bound at the betrothal process because you had entered into the pre-agreement of that marriage. And so in Matthew 1:19, Joseph, her husband, being a righteous man, was not wanting to disgrace her, desired to put her away secretly. He could not break that agreement unless if he went through a process called divorce. Hosea 2, verse 20, I will betroth you to me in faithfulness. Then you will know that I am the Lord. There is a planning stage to the wedding ceremony. The two families would meet together at a neutral site, perhaps a large furnished upper room, and that they would use for receptions and ceremonies later on. Mark 14, verse 15, that large upper room that they met in during the inauguration of the Lord's Supper was likely one of those type of rooms. And the parents of the groom would be in one corner, and the bride's parents would be in the other corner. And the parents would then leave their children. The two parents would go over, two sets of parents, in another corner together. And they'd be haggling over the dowry, the specifics of what they could concerning the arranged marriage. And meanwhile, the groom and the bride, they would be off in their opposite corners, and they're anxiously waiting. They want to get this process going. And now, once both parents were satisfied with the arrangement, maybe it was like 30 goats and a certain amount of money, whatever the dowry was, they would then go back to their respective corners like prize fighters, and the groom would then walk out into the center of the room. He'd be holding a cup of wine with his right hand. Facing his fiancée, who now came out, he would say something similar to this. This is symbolic of the blood I'm willing to shed for you if you will be my wife. And if she accepted, she would simply take the cup and drink of it. And the groom would also drink of it. And together, they were now engaged. Jesus, in the inauguration of the Lord's Supper, also in that large upper room, said this. He had taken the cup, Matthew 26, verses 27 through 29. And when he had taken the cup and given thanks, he gave it to them saying, this is wedding talk, drink from it, all of you, for this is the blood of my covenant, which is poured out for many for the forgiveness of sins. But I say to you, I will not drink of this fruit of the vine from now on until the day when I drink it new with you in my Father's kingdom. Now, if you could imagine just for a second, here he is with his closest disciples in that large upper room, likely one that had been used many times for weddings before. And combining that with the marital language of the Lord's Supper, the disciples would have been a bit perplexed. It would make sense later after the establishment of the church, the bride of Christ, and the Lord's Supper, but at the moment when they were going through this, that was kind of weird. That'd be almost like if we got up and we were offering the Lord's Supper and we say, you know, we are hereby gathered here today to join in union this congregation and this groom. You'd pick that up immediately as matrimonial speak. Well, this is what they would have done as well. Now, why would Jesus use wedding language during the inauguration of the Lord's Supper? It's because he's the groom and we're the bride. They would have had four during the Passover. A Jewish Passover, there are four cups. We know of three of those cups when Jesus inaugurated the Lord's Supper. But that fourth cup, that never happens. This Passover, they didn't have a fourth cup. Why? Because Jesus says, that one is reserved for you in the kingdom. Well, we just did. We just partook of that fourth cup with our Savior. And when we partake in the Lord's Supper on the first day of the week, we're recognizing our covenant to the best groom that ever came forward. Whoever held that cup up, he said, take, drink, be my bride, and you're the bride, he's the groom. I'm the bride, he's the groom. That's matrimonial speak. Ephesians 5:25-27 confirms that he loves his church and gave his life for her. He sanctified her. He cleansed her. He gloriously presents her before the Father without spot or wrinkle, holy and blameless. There is going to be a great wedding ceremony for the future. But as of today, we're in the engagement process. We are betrothed to Jesus Christ. Oh, I know we didn't have the big wedding feast, but that's a guarantee if you hold fast the words that he preached to us. And so it's a reminder that we are taken. That we're taken. You know, if somebody comes up to you and you're taken, somebody says, hey, good looking. That's what they say to me all the time. Hey, good looking. I say, I'm taken. I'm taken. In fact, even in our marital relationships, we never put that spouse ahead of that first groom. We never do that. God first, always. I want you to love you with all your heart, your soul, your mind. I want all of you. Your spouse did not die and was buried and resurrected for you. But hey, if your spouse takes second, if your spouse rides sidekick to Jesus, that's not a bad position. And so, with that in mind, the planning phase is done. But then came the preparation. The preparation. Immediately following that ceremony, what they would do is they'd head out. The ceremony of acceptance of betrothal, the groom and his family headed out for home and with the full intention of coming back for his bride. He's going to come back. And before he could do so, it'd be necessary to prepare a place to live for that bride. And so what he would do is he would go back to his father's house and they would just add another room onto that home. In the ancient days, a lot of times they would have, the fathers would have his house, and the oldest son, he would inherit that home, but they would just add more rooms. It was more of a complex. And his goal is over the next few months, or maybe even years, he would build the attached room to the father's home, laboring many hours a day. Attempting to complete the addition, the bride would have her bags packed and waiting because she doesn't know when this room will be done. Nobody really knows when that room will be done. And there will be no wedding ceremony until that room is complete. Because you got to have somewhere for the bride to live, right? Jesus said something of interest following the Lord's Supper in John chapter 14, verse 2 and 3. Once again, matrimonial language. Now, this is probably kind of freaking the apostles out a little bit, the disciples. He no sooner, he just finishes using matrimonial language to inaugurate the Lord's Supper. And in the very same period of time, he says this: "In my Father's house are many mansions, rooms. If it were not so, I would have told you. I go now to prepare a place for you, and I will come again and receive you to myself, that where I am, you may also be." This is marital talk. As the young man approaches the final stages of this addition, the father would come in to make the necessary inspections. And do you know what days they married back in the ancients? It wasn't Sunday. It wasn't Monday. It wasn't Tuesday. It was Wednesday. That was the day they had the wedding ceremony. We have it usually on Saturday here. But that was the day reserved for weddings. So every Wednesday, this father would come in. He would come into the room that was being added on, and he would do his inspection, put his little white gloves on, and he would maybe have his clipboard and say, "Well, that looks okay, that looks okay. Huh? Got to dock you on this one." And the son would ask, "Father, is it time yet? Is it time?" He's hoping that it's ready. And the dad would say, "No, it's not. It's not time yet. You need to do this, this, and this. Keep working on it." Jesus made reference in the Gospel of Mark, also matrimonial talk. He says, "But of that hour and day, no one knows, not even the angels of heaven, nor the Son, but the Father alone." Father knows best. He's the one who's got to give the final okay. Finally, this special Wednesday arrives. It might have been months, maybe even a year. He's been working on it, sanding down the mantle on the fireplace, hanging the ceiling fan that's powered by a couple of rats. I don't know. But he's having this place put together. He's pretty sure it's almost done. He sees the signs that it's going to be done. And the father comes in. And he says, "Father, is it time yet? Come on, Dad, give me the approval." And you know what? The father goes through and he says, "Yes, it's time. Yeehaw! I'm going to get me a bride." Well, here's what would happen. They now move to the procession phase. It's time to move into the procession phase of the wedding. The women of the groom's family are advised of the wedding ceremony, and they're told to prepare the house. There's going to be a wedding feast, for tonight our man is going to be betrayed. He's going to be married. And they begin by decorating the home and the food preparation. For tonight, there is going to be a wedding. The groom contacts the groomsmen, and he puts them on notice of the evening's events. Everybody clears their schedule. You must for a wedding and a funeral. And as evening approaches, the wedding procession begins. The groom gathers his attendants, his groomsmen, and they're actually slash movers. Because they're going to lead in procession across town or to the neighboring town. They're going to be carrying all that bride's stuff. There's two times in the ancients you needed to have a group of men. When you were married and when you were buried. One was moving her stuff to your place. The other one was moving you to the ground. But these guys are moving men. So here's what would happen. She has known from the moment he left, "You better have your bags packed, be ready, for you do not know the hour." He's coming back. He made a promise. He's coming back, but until then, you have your bags packed. And so, the groomsmen lead the groom in single file line. He never really comes in contact with the bride at all. He's just walking in the back as part of the procession. But he stands afar off as they approach. But the groomsmen, in Matthew 25, verses 5 through 7, also wedding speak. It says, now while the bridegroom was delaying, they all got drowsy and began to sleep. But at midnight there was a shout, behold, the bridegroom cometh. And then all the virgins rose and trimmed their lamps. You see, everybody knew there was going to be a wedding soon, but you didn't know. You knew it was going to be on a Wednesday. You didn't know what Wednesday it was going to be, so you better be ready. And as they would approach in this procession, they get maybe, I'd say, an eighth of a mile or maybe a tenth of a mile away. And that's when they would yell out. Everybody in the neighborhood who would see this crowd. I mean, listen, guys carrying lamps and torches walking through town. I mean, that's good news or bad news. In this case, it was good news. So they yell out, behold, the bridegroom cometh. And they're so excited. That bride, she might have been saying her prayers or taking some NyQuil or something, but it doesn't matter. She is going to get up. It is time. And her attendants had better be ready. They better have oil in their lamps, or they're not getting into that wedding at that point. And so the groomsmen procession arrives. The men load up the belongings of the bride on their backs and on the backs of mules, if she's does a lot of shopping. And the bridesmaids, escorting the bride with their lamps trimmed, they walk with their friend, like you would have in this picture up here. They're walking. You know, I got a first century flashlight at home from 50 AD, one of those little lamps. They put the oil in, put the little wick in it, and they would carry it. All of them would have it. And they'd be crying because it's such a happy time. They know they're going to the wedding of their best friend. And they're very excited for her. And they're happy because she will soon have her new family, new home, new future becomes reality. Well, with the groom at the front of the line now leading it back, the bride is in the back and the groomsmen are in between. You know the tradition we have, don't look at the bride, don't look at the bride. They were already doing that back then. In fact, a lot of things they were doing back then, we got from this culture. And so, watching the procession, people from their windows, admiring the slow movement of the gentle light of lamps on the backdrop of a starry sky, it would be absolutely moving for them. They'd be singing songs, Here Comes the Bride, or something like that. They'd be maybe doing the Hallel, Psalm 113 through 118. But they would, the environment in a small town, to see those little trail of people, that had to be so exciting. And this was before HBO and Showtime and distractions. This was what people were watching. And so now comes the presentation phase of it. Finally arriving at the home of the groom, the bride enters inside to undergo the ceremonial makeover. Meanwhile, the groom, he kind of hangs a right or a left, and he goes to a nearby house. And when he's there with his groomsmen, while she's getting all gussied up, he's waxing eloquently on how much he loves that bride. He's maybe written some poetry and is reciting that poetry. How do I love her? Let me count the ways. You know, maybe he's reading the Song of Solomon, but he's telling his groomsmen how much he loves this woman he's about to be married to. Jesus mentioned in the Gospels of Matthew and John, in Matthew 9:15, the attendants of the bridegroom cannot mourn as long as the bridegroom is with them, can they? But the days are coming when the bridegroom will be taken away from them. Then they will fast. This is their moment. This is where you get like the warped development into what they call bachelor parties. This is his last moment where he's with his homeboys and he's going to tell them and let them know how much he loves that woman. And it's just, these guys have to be smiling. Man, you're going to be so happy. She's going to be a good wife, and they're just talking about that wife. John 3:29, he who has the bride is the bridegroom. But the friend of the bridegroom who stands and hears him rejoices greatly because of the bridegroom's voice. This is a wonderful And so this joy of mine has been made full. It's a joyous time. The groom is garland with flowers around his neck. Meanwhile, the bride's family is preparing her for that preparation. Her face is without flaw. Her dress is beautiful. Her perfume is sweet. Her headdress is stunning. Her family has adorned her with only the finest. You know, yeah, it's an important day. Don't dress down, dress up. Isaiah 61:10, the bridegroom decks himself with a garland, and the bride adorns herself with jewels. Jeremiah 2:32, can a virgin forget her ornaments or a bride her attire? Of course not. It's probably the most important day in human relationships for this woman, period. So she's going to dress up. And then it's all ready. Everything is ready for the presentation. Someone comes over to the nearby house. They tell the groom, now's the time. Now's time for the ceremony. The bride is ready for the presentation. He follows the groomsmen as they lead the way. Their wonderful friend is about to transition into married life. Joel 2:16 says, let the bridegroom come out of his room and the bride out of her bridal chamber. His groomsmen enter the room one by one and they break to one side of it. He's seen the back of the head of the guy in front of him. And then all of a sudden when the last guy pulls over, boom, behold, the bride. His beautiful, beautiful bride. There wouldn't be a dry eye in the place as they observe the groom's expression of the joy he has at that moment. With a smile from ear to ear, he knows she is the most beautiful creature he has ever laid his eyes on. She has no fault, no blemish. She is a perfect match for him. Isaiah 62:5 says, as the bridegroom rejoices over the bride, so your God will rejoice over you. Revelation 21 verse 2, and I saw the holy city, New Jerusalem, coming down out of heaven from God, made ready as a bride adorned for her husband. And then comes the promise phase. The promise phase. Gently taking her by the hand, a blessing is offered for that new covenant. They are pronounced man and wife. It's now time for celebration of a wedding feast. There's great happiness, great food, great fellowship, causing many to rejoice for this moment. There is consummation of the in the attached room. They become one flesh. They are officially promised to each other before the eyes of their God. Revelation 19:9 says, and he said to me, write, blessed are those who are invited to the marriage supper of the Lamb. And he said, these are true words of God. Very simply put, what do we learn just from just some of the verses that enlighten us about the groom-bride relationship of heaven? Here's a summary. Remember, today's theme is unity. Come back tonight. If you didn't get enough unity, come back tonight. First, we as a church are betrothed to Jesus as the pure virgin bride. 2 Corinthians 11 verse 2. For I am jealous for you with a godly jealousy. For I betrothed you to one husband, that is to Christ, I might present you as a pure virgin. I mean, let's face it. We see our warts. But that's not how God sees his bride. I'm telling you, that man back in the first century, she might have had, you know, I mean, she might have had like a big old tattoo on her back or something that said Harley Davidson. I don't know. But I mean, when he sees that bride, she's without fault. I mean, she's perfect. That's what Jesus sees us as. He takes all of our sins and casts them as far as east is from the west, puts them into the depths of the sea. He remembers them no more. He casts them behind his back. He nails them to the cross. That's important to know. Because if we don't see that, we may think that that other person who's part of the bride, we might start judging them. We might stop treating them the way Jesus sees them. If you went to a wedding and you knew something about that bride and that groom was about to be married, and they said, if anybody has anything to say, let him hold his peace. He stood up and you said, she has a big wart on the back of her neck. That's not going to be cool. Okay? Maybe gift them some Compound W, but do not say anything that could insult that bride. It is Jesus' bride. This is not your bride. You are the bride. And we must treat her with respect as a pure virgin bride. Number two, we as a church know Jesus has prepared a place for us in heaven. We sing that song. You know, Revelation 22 verse 17, and the Spirit and the bride say, come. And let the one who hears say, come. And let the one who is thirsty come. And let the one who wishes to take the water of life without cost. Jesus has prepared a place for us. He did it on the cross when he emptied that tomb. He made it to where that city is perfectly cubed. And it's 144 furlongs apiece. That means there's room for everybody. Jesus added enough. There's no real estate problem in heaven. You want to go there? You got a place. Jesus has prepared a place for us. Years ago, there was this man. He decided he wasn't coming to church, and he said to his wife, she came out, and I remember talking to this couple. They were married like 60 years. They're long since gone, but he said, I'm not going to church today. Nothing but a bunch of hypocrites there. She said, well, fine. You can go there today and worship with them or burn in hell with them tomorrow. I'm going to go do what's right. He beat her to church. She was walking. He drove up and had his hair still wet, trying to straighten it out. He never missed church. The thing is, we have to understand, when we sing, when we all get to heaven, you don't have your own, you're not going to drive to heaven yourself. Go back and read 1 Thessalonians chapter 4. We all going at the same time. We're going to be in the same place. He prepared a place for us. You know, arranging to go down to Waco, you know, I was calling around trying to find some temporary housing until we do something more long term, and that's a pain in the neck. Imagine if you had to try and secure your own place in heaven. Jesus did that. And we need to understand that. Here's a third thing. We as a church know Jesus will be coming back for his bride. He's coming back. Luke chapter 12, 35 and 36. Be dressed in readiness and keep your lamps alight. And be like men who are waiting for their master when he returns from the wedding feast, so that they may immediately open the door to him when he comes and knocks. Jesus is coming back. And we better be ready. Together, we must be ready. We're all invited to that wedding feast. And Jesus is coming back to get us all. And he's not slack concerning his promises, some count slackness. And when he comes back, if we're not ready, go ask virgins who did not have oil in their lamps how joyous it was when that door shut. And they were out trying to get ready after the point of readiness. Number four, we as a church know there will be a great day of rejoicing. A great day of rejoicing. Revelation 19:7, let us rejoice and be glad and give glory to him, for the marriage of the Lamb has come, for his bride has made herself ready. We are going to have a great day of rejoicing. You can't crash this wedding if you have a ticket to get in. And it's going to be a grand celebration. It's going to blow anything away of any wedding feast you ever went to. It'll be absolutely exquisite. Our best days are ahead of us together. The best days. So if you're having a great time now, you can look back at today and say, man, that was never the good old days. This is the good old day here now, the one last day for eternity. Here's the fifth thing. We as a church must guard the image of the bride. We must guard the image of the bride. Ephesians 5:27, that he might present himself to the church in all her glory, having no spot or wrinkle or any such thing, but that she should be holy and blameless. I'm covering this for a simple reason. I know what happens in churches. I know what happens. And I don't want... The Lord's Supper was kind of chewy this morning. Jesus must have done yoga before he went down. But I'm telling you, I almost choked on it. But we have to guard the image of the bride. Imagine during a wedding, if somebody came in and the preacher said, stand for the bride, and everybody stands up and turns around and sees the bride. And she has a big old patch of hair ripped out of her head. She has a tooth knocked out. Her left eye is black. It's just blackened, punched out. Her dress is torn. She has a big old scratch down her arm, and she's missing a shoe. What would your reaction be to something like that? Stand for the bride. Thank you. I really need this. I do. Imagine your reaction. Stand for the bride. You turn, you go, like that. You'd be shocked. What happens when we don't present the image of the bride in the way that God wants us to? We attack somebody in the church, or we do something over here. We beat her up and we claw her up a little bit. What happens when the visitors stand up and they see that? That would be a very awkward moment for everyone in that wedding ceremony. We guard that bride jealously. We make sure that bride is always presented in the best possible way. And you can't have that if you're not united in that way. You can't have that. There will be no roast preacher, roast elder, roast teacher. There will be no hierarchy, lowerarchy. There won't be chaos. Because we will do things that say, listen, there's a wedding, and how dare I assault the bride in any way? We must, as a church, guard the image of the bride. So, there's going to be a great celebration. You are engaged to the best groom that ever carried that title. And you know what? You're the best bride that ever had that title. We have an obligation to live in such a way, but we must first be betrothed. You know, when somebody is baptized into Christ, I got to tell you about Reuben. Reuben was baptized Friday. Reuben was here when God made water, so it's kind of a unique thing. But no, Reuben was baptized. He's 80 years old, and he came back for another baptism. He was baptized at 7. And he was like the Energizer Bunny when he came out. And he drove all the way to Hershey. And he came back. And I came here for a baptism close to midnight. Reuben jumps out of the car. He was here before me. And he had all this energy. And he brought me some Hershey chocolates. He was all happy. I said, man, like, you've been here the whole... No. He was so excited. He looked like he was going to basic training. He was thrilled. Let me tell you. When you enter covenant, you become part of that bride. And if you can't be excited about that, I don't know what will drive you. There are people here who never entered the covenant of Christ yet. They're believers. They have a relationship with God, but they don't have a covenant. The difference is from dating to marriage to having a relationship and having a covenant. When we're baptized into Christ, we have taken that relationship to a brand new level. A level that can never be higher. And in the covenant, you're afforded all the terms and conditions that are spelled out for you. The happiest times I've ever had here is when I see someone enter that covenant. And the saddest time I will ever have is when I leave, after all we've talked about, after all we've shared, and you still don't enter that covenant. Don't be banging on the door of the wedding feast. Be a guest. I hope that you will come forward and be baptized, taking that relationship to a brand new, highest level. You might say, well, I was baptized before. Well, if you weren't baptized to get into covenant, if you were baptized to join a church, or you were baptized because you were already saved, or you were a child and you knew nothing of a wedding, you have a decision to make. And I hope you make the decision to go to the same wedding feast as everybody else that is here today. And it'll be a huge one. Think about that while we offer an invitation song for you to come forward and receive your wedding invitation.